It's great to be here and seeing places in the world that I would not have otherwise seen, and to meet the Swedish people and see your beautiful cities here has been lovely. So I just would like to start by telling you who I am and how I came to be doing what I'm doing today, because many of you may not know that, and I think it's important to understand where I came from, because I think it will give you a better picture of the validity of what I'm saying. And I realize that I'm speaking English, and that is not everybody's native language, so if there's a word or something that needs to be translated, you can just raise your hand and somebody will translate. I'm speaking much slower than I usually do, and much more clearly, and so hopefully that will help. And maybe we could keep questions to the end so that we can keep this moving smoothly. First off, I will tell you that I lost my glasses, and I wonder where I could have put them. Oh, here they are. I started out in college, in university, and I got a bachelor's degree in physics, and then I worked in a laboratory for several years, and in that time, I decided that I wanted to work with people and not rats and dead cow brains and things like that that I was working with. So I went to medical school and had one of the happiest days of my life. The day I graduated was felt like a big accomplishment. And then I moved on to my residency in New York City. And during that period, I realized something that I did not realize before I went to medical school, which is that what I had really become was a highly trained technician for the pharmaceutical industry. And this was saddening to me, because my original intention was to go and be able to heal people and cure their diseases and bring them to higher levels of health. And I didn't learn to do that in medical school. I learned to do that later in the past few years. Now, I don't have anything completely against the pharmaceutical industry, because I have witnessed the miracles of giving a drug to somebody who needs it when they need it. It's fantastic. If you want to get rid of a symptom, pain, if you have organ failure, we need this kind of medicine. The problem is that when people have minor issues, health issues, that this kind of medicine is used automatically as first line of defense, and none of these drugs from pharmaceutical industry bring people to higher states of natural health. Whereas there are many nutraceuticals and nutritional advice that can be given to people that can do that, and then they can avoid these drugs. And that's really my belief at this point in how I practice medicine, but that wasn't always the case. So during my residency, when I realized this problem, I decided that instead of doing things to people that were healthy that I did not necessarily agree with, like sending them for mammograms and vaccinating them and all of the things that we do to healthy people in the narrow corridor that I was allowed to work within the conventional medical system, I thought, well, let me take what I've learned and try to just use it on really sick people. So I specialized in kidneys. And so that took 5 more years beyond medical school to do all of that. And I worked for approximately 14 years in doing nephrology, which is practicing with mostly with kidneys and high blood pressure and diabetes and things like that, some metabolic diseases. And I taught medical students, I taught residents, and I taught doctors in that period of time. I worked in academia. I have a couple of papers published in peer-reviewed journals. And it was around 2009 that that there was something that did not feel right to me. And that was when several people came in to the hospital having new onset kidney failure after they had been vaccinated for the swine flu. And that year in USA, we had separate vaccine, one for swine flu, one for seasonal flu. And for whatever reason, I know you folks had a problem with that vaccine as well, but we had a different problem as far as I'm concerned. And that was people told me that they were fine until they had that vaccine. And then all of a sudden they had had normal kidney function, and all of a sudden they now needed dialysis. And several people this happened with. And I thought, well, this is a problem that we need to investigate, because any drug that causes kidney failure, we would stop and we would discuss it. But when it came to vaccination, the response I got from my colleagues and coworkers was very different. And so I brought this problem to the administration, and they told me that these patients did not have kidney failure from the flu shot, and that they had flu, and that's why they had kidney failure. But these patients had no flu symptoms, so they were they had no basis to say what they were saying to me. And after that, I started to ask questions when new patients would come to me, either with new problems or with worsening of old problems. And this is a question that every doctor needs to add to their list of questions, which is, when was your last vaccine? Because often you will make a correlation between a new symptom and a vaccine, and often you will find numerous case reports in the peer-reviewed medical literature that can support the potential for the vaccine to cause this problem. So once I did that, I saw that there was a correlation, and oftentimes I would see within 24 hours of a vaccine, for instance, a patient in the hospital would come in with borderline normal kidney function, get a vaccine, and kidney function would go down within 24 hours, and the vaccine was still denied as the cause. Our hospital was vaccinating people who, I remember I walked into a room, and there was a young man who had cancer, some sort of lymphoma, and he was on chemotherapy. And the pharmacist had just come in to offer him a flu shot and a pneumonia shot, and he had consented to say okay, and they were about to give it. And I canceled that order and realized later that in our hospital, the policy was that my patients could be vaccinated under my name for the order, even though I didn't order it. That was the policy, to offer every patient that was conscious, no matter what their disease, these vaccines. And so I think that should stand out to everybody as problematic. Now, would you want to give a flu shot and a pneumococcal vaccine to a man who has cancer and is on chemotherapy right that moment? That seems very logical to me to just say no, you wouldn't do that. I saw vaccines being given to people who are having heart attacks while they were having the heart attacks, while they had active sepsis, while they had new onset kidney problems, and numerous other ailments, that there was no scientific literature to support vaccinating. But the ethos was, vaccines are safe and effective, and they need to be given. Well, I started doing research at that point, and what I found was very much counter to tradition and to what I had been told in medical school. You may not know this, but doctors are not taught about vaccines in medical school. We are not taught what's in vaccines as far as the adjuvants. We are not taught how vaccines are manufactured as far as what kind of animals go into them. We are not taught the potential dangers of vaccination. And we are basically given a piece of paper that says when the vaccines are due and to give them. And I found this to be very alarming, and even more so when I researched the history of smallpox and the history of polio, two diseases that I was continuously told were eradicated by vaccination. My research that I wrote in a book with Roman Bistrionic was completely counter to that, and in fact, populations who stopped vaccinating for smallpox, their smallpox diseases declined, and death from smallpox declined. And with the polio vaccine, the story is so complicated, but basically just saying that I today do not believe that the injected polio vaccine is the reason why we saw polio go away. It does not make polio go away at all. It can still be passed around through populations. And the polio is not what I once thought it was. So given all that, I decided to leave my conventional job and do research. And today I study between 6 and 12 hours every day, 7 days per week, learning immunology, history, toxicology, genetics, and all kinds of things that one must understand in order to know the deeper details of the problems with vaccination. So what I'm going to tell you today is largely based on my research and on peer-reviewed literature. You will see on many of my slides, there will be a number called PMID, and you can go and look up these articles that I will be showing you by going to PubMed.com and put that number in, and these articles will come up. Many of them, you will get full text, and some of them you'll get just the abstract. And I think that it is important for you to hear both sides. Now, I'm well aware that the medical authorities use fear in order to get populations to vaccinate. I have evidence of that, which I can show you. I'm also well aware that they do not think that you should be educated and informed, but the authorities tell doctors to persuade you and to use fear if necessary, and to kick you out of their office if you will not vaccinate. And these are the kind of tactics and techniques that are used to get people to vaccinate themselves and their babies. And I don't think this is fair. I think that you are all intelligent enough to look at both sides and decide for yourself, should I vaccinate my baby? Should I vaccinate myself? Should I recommend vaccines to my mother and father? And it's a big problem when people are told not to look at the other side. And what you might notice, if you've been in the middle of this problem yourself, is that the people who want to vaccinate are often very aggressive, and they don't want you to hear the other side. And that should make a light bulb in your head go off. Why don't they want me to hear the other side? Why don't they think I can actually listen to both and come up with my own decision? See, I will never tell you not to vaccinate, but they will always tell you to vaccinate for everything. That alone, I believe, should be a red flag to you, that I'm saying you listen to everything and then you choose. What you do is your responsibility. And that's not what the people who are supporting this aggressive vaccination campaigns, more and more vaccines all the time to little babies, that's not what they're saying. So tonight I have many things I could talk to you about. I have many things that I prepared, but usually when I travel, there's always the question that comes back again and again. And last year was tetanus. A lot of people wanted to know about tetanus because polio and tetanus happen to be two diseases that people believe, even if they don't believe in all vaccines, that they believe that they may want to still vaccinate for these, as I did. Now, also, I want you to know that...
I just want to make sure that everyone knows what tetanus is. It's the stelkramp. Yes.
No. Okay.
Stelkramp.
Yeah. Okay. I used to believe in vaccines. I used to give vaccines, okay? So it's not like I always had this this problem against the vaccines. I was vaccinated before medical school. I was vaccinated as a child, but I was not vaccinated to the degree that babies are vaccinated today. And there were nowhere near as many vaccines then. So in my research, in the beginning of my research, I thought, well, there still must be some vaccines that I would take. But now there are no vaccines that I would take, okay? That's just for me. I don't care if I'm going to Sri Lanka or Africa. There's no vaccine that I would take after doing my research, because I'm willing to accept responsibility for the outcome of whether I do vaccinate or whether I don't vaccinate. And because I have researched how to keep myself healthy, how to keep my immune system working, even if I'm faced with Ebola virus, okay? So I don't have any fear of dying from infection because I've done my research, and you are all capable of doing that. In fact, most parents have developed a level of understanding of the immune system and health and vaccination far above what their doctors know. And that's my belief, is that is why the health authorities tell doctors not to talk to you, because they know that most doctors will lose the argument unless they have taken the time to really understand. And most doctors don't have the time to take that I have. And they don't have the time to sit and research both sides. So they have to, by default, listen to the authorities and do as they're told. So I'm not saying doctors are bad people. I'm not saying they're evil. I'm saying that doctors are not informed and they're too busy to get informed. So it's your job to get informed because you are the best line of defense for your children. Okay? This is from a little magazine that is very highly read in America. It's very popular, called Reader's Digest. And Kathleen Sebelius is our Secretary of Health and Human Services, a very high-level position in government. And she said that there are groups out there, like me, who say that vaccines are responsible for problems. And they say that we have reached out to the media to try to get the media not to give me my view or equal weight, because she says the science has already shown the safety and effectiveness of vaccination, so my voice should not be heard. I couldn't disagree with that more, because the more science I know, the more indignant and upset I get, because I know that the science shows major problems with the theory of vaccination and with the practice of vaccination. This is a PowerPoint presentation that comes from Mayo Clinic. This is a very prestigious institution in USA, and this is one of our leading vaccine promoters in USA. And he made a PowerPoint presentation to give to all doctors to help them talk to people who don't want to vaccinate. And I just took out a couple of slides to show you. It was a very long presentation, but he basically is coaching these doctors how to deal with you. Here's one of the major problems is that this fellow, and this is common, okay, the pro-vaccine world is rife with conflict of interest. These doctors that are promoting vaccines, by and large, have some sort of interest in the vaccine being taken up by the public. So here's just a little list of his conflict of interest. There are numerous conflict of interest of this gentleman, and they're listed in many of his papers because they have to list them. They say, don't plan on giving you any printed information. Don't plan on emailing you any links to information. Does that seem a little strange? They're saying not to give you the information. They said, instead, read and remember. Well, that's not happening. I can guarantee you that. This, I think, is the worst, most egregious statement here, which is he's telling them to persuade you rather than inform you. Okay, so you know now. This was a PowerPoint presentation to doctors. This here is from Dr. Lance Rodewald from the Division of Immunization Services, Center for Disease Control. He was quoted in the New York Times in 2004, and you can read right there, frightening parents about the consequences of failing to vaccinate their children will most likely be part of the campaign. For the task, meningococcal meningitis is ideal. And frightening you is key to getting you to do what they want you to do. And let me just show you something that happened in New Zealand. Speaking of fear, we had a vaccine there called meningococcal B, and this was the informed consent. Okay, right. Give your consent. People holding pen. On the other side had a baby that was dying from some sort of hemorrhagic disease. But one of the authorities said that protection is expected to last for a few years, but the exact period is unknown. So many of these babies were given 3 and 4 vaccines that had huge amounts of aluminium in them. And later on, we found out that there were even more problems with this vaccine, that they used a lot of fear to get the public to take up. In 4 years, 109 cases of the epidemic that they were trying to cover were reported, and they were all people who were vaccinated. 60 were partially vaccinated and 49 were fully vaccinated. Parents were lied to about this vaccine, and in these studies that showed how long the vaccine lasted, they found that the antibody that was made went away very rapidly, somewhere between 2 and 7 months after all three of those doses. Not only that, but they found that you could be vaccinated for this. Anyone who was vaccinated for this still carry the bacteria. It didn't get rid of the bacteria, okay? And so these doctors, here's another New Zealand Herald saying that it provided only short-term protection, and this doctor said parents should have been told more clearly about this. So this is the problem with being scared into doing something before you understand what's happening. This was an expensive lesson for New Zealand. Nowhere in the consent did it mention that immunity dropped below protective levels within 2 months. And the failure to inform parents at the time was disgraceful, according to writings in public in the New Zealand Herald. $200 million were put into this campaign. And after that, officials were determined to conceal anything that might cause unease, and everybody was just hush-hush about it. Well, I'd like to show you something else, and that is the data showed from 2006, 2007, 2008, there were 12 deaths from this particular bacteria, and every one of them was in a vaccinated child. Not a single one was an unvaccinated child. Okay? So here we have the meningitis was coming down. Here's where they started vaccinating, and here we see what the death rate did after they began to vaccinate. This is what can happen when a population is frightened with pictures like this, thinking of your baby being that baby. We saw this happen in the 1950s with polio, and it will continue to happen. I guarantee you we will soon be seeing people dying of Ebola and pictures of them, whether it's Ebola or not, and we will be offered this vaccine. So we have to be very cautious when fear is used in a campaign, because the result is that we stop thinking. So we must always continue to think even in the presence of fear. Keep our minds open, read as much as you can, and continue to stay healthy, which is always the key to decreasing disease rates. And when I say to stay healthy, I mean nutritionally. I mean paying attention to what we're eating, paying attention that we have the right nutrients, that we're not eating lots of food that has no nutrient value, that we're not scared all the time, because fear, guess what fear does? It raises your cortisol levels and makes your immune system not function properly. Okay, so now on to tetanus, because I wanted to talk about fear, because this has long been the picture that is used to show you why you need to vaccinate your baby. This is untreated tetanus from 150 years ago. Tetanus is a terrible disease. We don't want it to happen to anybody, but what I'd like to show you today is how the idea that the vaccine is what why we don't see very much of it, and that the vaccine is safe and effective, that none of those things is actually borne out in reality when we look at the science and the history. So I just want to tell you a little bit about the disease, because it comes from a bacteria. It's a special kind of bacteria, and this is what it looks like when it's in the soil. And it lives in the intestines of ruminant animals like cows and horses, and it comes out in the stool. So back in the old days when we were riding horses through the streets, you can imagine there was a lot of this, much more of it around. So this tennis racket-shaped bacteria is totally harmless. You can eat this, you can get it into your wounds, and it will not cause any disease, so long as it has oxygen. Once you deprive this of oxygen, this occurs, it shape-shifts. This is a close-up, a really nasty little thing with all these flagellae, and it can move around. And some, but not all, of the strains will produce a toxin, okay? And it's called tetanospasmin. And that, in very small doses, is highly toxic and can be lethal to the nervous system. And that's the basis of tetanus. So we know that you can have tons of this in your wound, and if you properly treat the wound and leave it, and air can get to it and no abscess forms, and you continue to disinfect, that you will not develop tetanus. Okay, so it's very key for a wound to heal from inside out. You don't want a wound to start to seal over on the outside before the inside is healed properly, because anything that's trapped under the skin will fester, there won't be enough air, and this susceptibility can happen. So I already told you where tetanus is most found, but we can also find it just about everywhere else in smaller concentrations. We find it in houses. We find it also in the past in some sterile cotton dressings from hospitals. 5 to 40% of the population carries tetanus in their stool and is not sick from it. The disease mostly happens in moist, warm climates, near the equator, in undeveloped countries where there's livestock. This Dr. Holmes in 1940 wrote the textbook on these kinds of diseases. And what he said, something interesting that I highlighted, is that tetanus is not primarily a war disease, but it's a disease that claimed the greatest number of victims among women and children. Yet we see this man lying naked, you know, in tetanospasm. That's the image we always see, but the truth is it was women and children. And sadly, the medical system was often the source of the infection. If you look at this paper from 1937, this doctor outlines that vaccination was often the preceding event before tetanus. Circumcision, medical dressings and sanitary towels, abortions, hysterectomies, and childbirth itself. Because if you know history, and we wrote about this in our book, that puerperal fever claimed thousands upon thousands of women, and it was completely avoidable if doctors had only washed their hands between going to the morgue and going to deliver babies. And there were doctors that were telling, there were two doctors in particular, one in Austria and one in USA, saying, please wash your hands with this special soap because we can get this problem down to almost zero. And they were laughed at and ridiculed. And both of them ended up leaving medicine. But later we found out that they were right. And all of these mothers could have survived, their babies would have survived, and the reverberation, the after effect of these mothers dying was huge upon society because there were all these babies and children left without mothers, which increases disease rates, increases death rates. Okay, so let's look back at a little bit of history. This comes from Dr. Nelson, infectious disease book from 2005, and this comes out of a big institution in the United States. And in this textbook, we have a quote that says that the decline in mortality from infectious diseases during the 20th century stands as a tribute to advances in public health and safer lifestyles compared with that in previous centuries. And that's really what our book shows, is that these changes in society and lifestyles and improvements in nutrition had more to do with the decline in death and in many cases with incidence of diseases than anything else, including antibiotic invention, including vaccination. As proof, I'd like to show you some infectious diseases. This is the year 1900. This is the year 1935, and this is the year 1970. Let's look at how the death rate went down for these diseases. Influenza and pneumonia claimed 202 per 100,000 in 1900 in the United States. In 1935, before there was any vaccine whatsoever, we were down by half. And by 1970, before the vaccination programs were really up and running, we're down even further. The original vaccines for influenza in USA, if you look at the writing of a doctor named Dr. Anthony Morris, who worked at the Division of Biologic Sciences, which is now the National Institutes of Health, his job was to determine the safety of these vaccines. And he determined not only were they not safe in the 1970s, but they were no more effective than tap water. And he testified to this effect in front of the Senate, and he was definitely a qualified person to make that statement. Today, we are still offered these vaccines for influenza despite any real support for their effectiveness, despite any well-designed studies for their safety, and despite the fact that the most prestigious collaboration called the Cochrane Collaboration, who evaluates different aspects of medicine, is saying that the hype and the media information on influenza is completely out of proportion to the science. Okay, so let's look now at measles. We had 31 per 100,000 deaths in 1900, down to 2.7 long before the measles vaccine came in. And I'll show you in a minute that it was almost down to zero right before the vaccine came on the scene. Okay, so I always thought the tetanus was much more prevalent than it actually was, but it turns out that, look, you don't even find tetanus on most charts like this because it was such a low incidence disease. So we had 4 per 100,000 back in the time when all these other things were claiming people's lives. And then by 1935, before tetanus vaccines, we had 0.95. So let's move on here, and I'm going to show you some more graphs in a minute. But I also want to show you a quote from this article from 1980. And this doctor says that the death rate from tuberculosis, diphtheria, scarlet fever, all these other things, started to fall long before the introduction of vaccinations or antibiotics. And that's exactly what Roman and I found when we did our research looking at vital statistics in parts of the world where they were available from the mid-1800s and onwards. This is another chart from our book, and it shows you the death rate in England and Wales from various diseases. Now, you can take pictures if you like. I'm happy for you to take pictures, but I'll tell you that if you go to dissolvingillusions.com, you can actually see all of the graphs that are in the book in color for free. You can also read the author's introduction, and you can read, I think it's the first page of every chapter. So let's look at measles, okay? Measles is the green line. And you can see the death rate for measles was quite high, you know, around 40 per 100,000. And then it started to decline around the time when food was improving, child labor laws were being instated, and when plumbers came on the scene and the sewage was separated from the drinking water. And look, here's when the measles vaccine came. Interesting, isn't it? It was almost down to zero. We have the exact numbers, but it's like 0.3 or something like that. Okay, here we have scarlet fever. Now, scarlet fever vaccines were developed, but they found that they really only gave them to healthcare workers sporadically, and that there were so many problems with these vaccines, allergic reactions, that they never really used them in mass production. But here we see a disease that, so we can say they really never vaccinated the masses for scarlet fever, but look, death rate for scarlet fever. And it was down here. A lot of people say, well, that's because we have antibiotics, Dr. Humphreys. But antibiotics were created here, down here, around the 19th. There were some not so great antibiotics in the late 1930s, late 1940s, and the early 1950s is when penicillin came. But you can see the death rate was down because the people were stronger. And that's really important. The people being strong is much more important than the microbe being strong. Do you know that bubonic plague that used to take a quarter of the population and wiped out masses in Europe, do you know we still have that in USA? You don't hear about it because not a lot of people are dying from it. Okay, here we have whooping cough. And again, you see the same thing. Here's when whooping cough vaccine came in. So it's just silly to say that vaccination is responsible for the decline in death rate. Okay, so let's get back to tetanus, because we're often told that, you know, once we gave this vaccine, we saw this enormous drop in death and cases. And we're shown this graph here. And it really does look like, you know, the tetanus vaccine came in around here, and look, we have this ski slope coming down. But the problem is, and this is how you'll be shown by the public health authorities, all the vaccine success. They don't show you the whole graph. Here's what happens when you look at the whole graph. We can see that it was already coming down, and then it came down further. But look at how much more dramatic it was in England and Wales. And we can see that the decline in incidence of mortality is here, and the vaccine came in here, and we actually see it come up a little bit after the vaccine came in. And this is the same thing in Canada. You know, we see that the death rate from tetanus, they only started reporting cases here, but we could see the death rate was just precipitously falling. And this is the year the vaccines came in. And again, we see for some strange reason an increase right there, but we can't say that we have tetanus vaccines to thank, because the trend was already seriously coming down. I keep saying it's about the people, it's about the people, it's not about the microbe. There are some situations where the people, their immune systems and their blood flow isn't so good, and so they can become more susceptible. So diabetics, we know, are much more susceptible than non-diabetics. They don't have the best blood flow to the skin, and that's part of the problem, is that you need to keep oxygen coming into a wound to prevent tetanus. They have high sugar rates in the blood, and that also feeds bacteria. And they tend to have higher inflammation and lower vitamin C levels. Drug injectors, it's the same thing. They're just chronically ill, they're much more susceptible, and they're putting dirty needles into their skin, which doesn't help very much. The diagnosis is basically one made by looking at a patient. We don't have any tests to show that we can make this just by testing. We know that only 40% of all cases are ever reported in USA, and so I also know personally of three cases that the parents insisted were tetanus, that the clinical scenario was completely consistent with tetanus, but the doctors would not report it as tetanus because the patients were vaccinated. And this is something that happens after vaccines. We see it happen after the pertussis vaccine. We wrote about that. Things change. The diagnostic criteria often change after a vaccine is introduced, so that less cases get reported just because of that. But there's also bias not to report the vaccinated, or even to think that the vaccinated have the disease. And this is also written about in many medical journals, that we're missing tetanus cases because we don't think of it because of the vaccine. Well, because I've been to Finland twice, and because they first asked me for this, I looked up their history of tetanus. And since they're your neighbors, I think that's fair enough to show you. So let's look at this article from 1993. Is that me making is that background noise in the speakers? No, okay. Tell me if you hear, I feel like I'm hearing something. So there were 106 cases of tetanus between 1969 and 1985. Five of them were children. Four of them had received adequate vaccination against tetanus. So the point I'm making now is that this vaccine has never been and still is not anywhere close to a guarantee that your child will not develop tetanus. You have to do other things to work towards your child not getting tetanus. Another thing I want to tell you about is that you will be told the statistics on death rates. For instance, you'll be told how many children die every year of measles, and you'll be told that's why you need to get a measles vaccine. But what they won't tell you is that those deaths, by and large, are in Africa, in countries where people are starving. The same goes with tetanus, is that we're told about all these deaths that are happening every year still from tetanus, but they're not here, and they're certainly not in babies. In Finland, the last case of baby tetanus was in 1915, and they did not start vaccinating babies until 1957. So after doing my research, it's my determination that there's no reason to give an infant a tetanus vaccine. Even if they worked, it's not necessary. Babies are not, the reason babies used to get this is because people didn't understand how to use sterility techniques and the cord. And so they were putting mud on it, or they weren't using proper surroundings or the wrong dressings that had bacteria in them. So this isn't happening anymore. This slide is just showing you a study that shows that the difference between the vaccinated and the not vaccinated as far as antibody isn't that great, is that some of these unvaccinated children still have high antibody levels, and the vaccinated, you know, similar to the vaccinated. So we can't just go by antibody levels because it does not very well correlate to the level of protection. And you can see the death rate in the non-vaccinated was 42.9 and in the vaccinated was 50%. So it's a little, always a little more complicated than they like to simplify things for you. Okay, so we're often told about herd immunity. And you might be familiar with that term. Are you familiar? Okay, so that's basically saying that you're irresponsible if you don't vaccinate yourself or your child because you're putting other people at risk. Well, there's a few problems with that theory. One is that if people trust their vaccines, they shouldn't be worried about what you're doing. But even more problematic to me is the more I understand about vaccines, the more I understand that so many of the people that are vaccinated are actually developing the disease and then infecting other people, oftentimes shortly after they're vaccinated. You know, I used to think this didn't happen, but just recently I came across an article about cases in Croatia where these children were vaccinated for measles, mumps, rubella, and about a week after the vaccination, they developed measles and infected other people. And the article said that in the past, they would have never made the link that it was vaccine strain causing the infections, because they would have either called it another disease because the child was vaccinated, or they would have thought it was a wild virus, not from the vaccine. But now that we have the ability to test, is it vaccine strain or is it wild, we're seeing that these vaccines can and do infect after these people are vaccinated. We know it happens with rotavirus, the swallowed virus that are given to infants, and we know that it happens with oral polio vaccines. We know it happens with measles, and we've always known it's happened with rubella. So when people want to use this herd immunity argument, it's really not very rational. And this concept of herd immunity really came from a time when people were not vaccinating. There was a doctor who looked at the populations and he noticed that when 95% of the population of children below 15 had had measles, that epidemics were at a very low rate. And when that changed, when that dropped, then they would see some outbreaks. But it wasn't that people were dying left, right, and center, because as we know, the death rate went down not as a result of vaccination. So this concept of herd immunity does really not apply to vaccination for several reasons. One, I already told you, the vaccines can spread disease. But two, because if we just take measles, for instance, anybody here over the age of 70? Did you have measles growing up?
Yes.
And how was that for you?
Well, I had measles. I read the notes my mother made at that time.
Okay.
And she wrote, he had measles, and she wasn't too bad. And I called she called her friend to bring her daughter to me. So she could catch measles as well. That's what mothers did at that time.
Measles parties, because they wanted to get it over with. Yeah.
My mother's friend was a nurse.
Yeah.
Very, very talented nurse, and she brought her liver on.
Thank you.
I did not plant her in the audience. I want everybody to know that. But I know that there's always somebody over 70 in my audience, and they always say that same thing. Did you know anybody that went blind from measles? Did anybody you know went blind from measles?
Never.
Did you know of anybody who died from measles?
No,
okay.
No.
All right, we're so far 100% on that, these questions. Cod liver oil has vitamin A, and it's been known about since the 1940s that is key to recovery from measles, because for whatever reason, the measles virus makes the body consume enormous amounts of vitamin A. And without that, that's when you get this problem with the eyes. And the medical authorities used to say, what did they tell you? Just keep you in a dark room. But that's no cure for blindness or for photophobia, you have to treat the disease, not just put them in a dark room. So the vitamin A was very important. And today we now know that 400,000 units a day to someone who has measles makes a huge difference in the recovery time and in the rate of secondary infections. The other thing is that people were wanting their children to be infected with measles because they wanted to get it over with. It was a mild disease of limited duration. Our health authorities knew that and wrote about that before the vaccine was invented. But today, young people, I mean, can you imagine having your one-year-old infected with measles? Doesn't that just make you feel horror? Now, why would that be? It's because of what you've heard and what you've read. Because after a vaccine is invented, there tends to be lots of reports of the bad things that can happen, like chickenpox, which anyone my age would have had chickenpox. But we're told in America that that this is a very dangerous disease and people are dying of secondary staph infections. But problem is that doctors often give antibiotics and fever reducers to these problems, and that makes everything worse. I had another thought before I get to your question, which is that you had measles, you have 75 years worth of immunity. I was vaccinated. I probably don't have immunity to measles right now. So I am potentially more of a threat to the herd than you are. Okay, my babies would not be getting the advantage of my immunity. So my babies are more not only a threat to the herd immunity, but they're threatened by my lack of immunity. Your babies got much more immunity from your placenta, from your milk. And so they were protected by you and by real herd immunity. Now, as people your age are dying, older than you, of course, are dying, we're losing the true herd and we're being replaced by these false herd. And so they're telling us now that we need to revaccinate. But for tetanus, this can't happen. And that's because we will never get rid of the spores in the environment. And I cannot give you tetanus, so it's not contagious from person to person. What was your question?
No, not a question.
That was a lady back there.
I just wanted to ask. I had measles when I was a child, and it went very well. But then I came to hospital for something different later, and I there shared a room with a girl who was 17, and she had brain damage, and they said that was from measles.
Yeah. Well, see, measles has to be treated properly. That's part of the problem, is that, first of all, I would say, how many vaccines did that child have beforehand? I would say, did she get breastfed? I'd want to know that, because that's a huge deal when it comes to the development of our immunity. Breastfeeding not only helps the baby develop their immunity, but it makes you stronger even as an adult, okay? So, and I would want to know, did those doctors give that girl antibiotics when she had measles, which will basically disrupt the real immunity in the bowel because it napalms the bowel. And I would want to know if she got vitamin A and vitamin C. Now, those are things that I would ask of that person before I would automatically say that it was all because of a virus. Yeah, okay, I'm gonna just keep going now because we can do the questions at the end. Okay, let's talk a little about the vaccine. I'm going to skip over a lot of these because I have about 150 slides. Okay, so I will tell you that I have a stack of medical literature papers, of case reports, of fully vaccinated people with very high antibody levels, or even just normal antibody levels, who developed tetanus disease, some of the worst kind of tetanus disease. So why could that happen? Well, I put this little picture in to show you because what we have is, this is just an anatomical view. And on the outside, of course, you have skin. And so when that skin can be disrupted or dying pieces of skin, then tetanus bacteria loves to live in dead flesh. That's its favorite place to live, dead flesh with low oxygen. So if we have that happen, look that we have, see all these yellow things are nerves. See the yellow lines coming up and they come up here and they go into the central nervous system and up into the brain. And these red ones are arteries, and there should be blue ones in here too, but I guess it's not a complete drawing. But so there's veins and arteries. So everything travels in the same place, in the same direction. Nerve, artery, vein, lymphatics. They all always go together. So if tetanus toxin comes into the body and is generated in the body, and if it gets to the nerve before the blood gets to it, then it doesn't matter how high your antibody levels are. You can still have tetanus go up to the brain and either kill you or make you very sick. No, it doesn't matter how many times you've been vaccinated. So that's why wound care is the most important thing when it comes to preventing tetanus. Okay, so where does the vaccine come from? Well, I just told you that tetanus loves to live on dead flesh. And I think it's important before you give a vaccine to your child to learn where they all come from, because it's nothing like what I used to think, and so maybe it's not what you used to think, but I used to think that they just somehow magically got a piece of bacteria or a piece of virus and put it in some salt water and injected it into me, and that was it. But in order to make a vaccine, you have to mass produce the virus or the bacteria or whatever microbe makes the toxin, in this case, tetanus bacteria. So they have to find a way to mass produce this tetanus bacteria without oxygen. So they basically take a beef heart or a piece of, you know, cow meat, and they combine it with pancreas from another animal to dissolve it and put these cells on plates and let them grow. They don't have to do it this way anymore, but probably everybody in this room who is an adult was vaccinated with this kind of a vaccine. Today they have the ability to make them using soy and using non-animal, but they don't necessarily. They still use this technique. So the vaccines are made on rotten meat, heart, and with pancreas juice, and then they also have to keep these cells alive, and you can't keep them alive with vegetable juice, unfortunately. You have to put blood on them, and so they will get cow blood and cow albumin and make special solutions to keep these cells alive while they're making the bacteria that makes the toxin. Then they take the toxin and they have to deactivate it so that it doesn't kill you when they inject you with it. So they do that using formaldehyde, and that's how we get that. So in the end, what we end up with is traces of mercury still in there, a good dose of aluminium in order to make you respond to the very tiny inactivated toxin and formaldehyde. And you would think that it was just nice and pure and that's all we have, but we don't. What we find from this paper here, even in 2014, is that they're reporting that not only is there a lot of variability from batch to batch, meaning non-homogeneous, but it contains proteins from the culture medium, from the bacteria, and from degradation products. Degradation would mean your rotten meat here. Just very tiny amounts. They'll show you it's just very teeny, teeny, tiny amounts, and that we shouldn't worry about that. Moving right along, safety, as far as vaccines go, has a specific definition, and that is that we can only say it's safe in relation to the condition of you when you're given it. So in other words, you could have a disease that we don't know about, like an immunoglobulin deficiency, or a cancer, or a mitochondrial disease. And then you get this vaccine and or genetic disorder, say, and then the vaccine can trigger a problem. And then they will blame you because you had this pre-existing condition and not necessarily is it a problem of the vaccine. So this is something you should know about. And also that most of the time, at least in the beginning of vaccine trials, that they're tested on healthy people, that if you have anemia or you've recently had a blood transfusion or you're on certain medications, they won't take you in a trial for vaccine, but they'll still offer you the vaccine later after it comes to market. We have zero placebo saline-controlled safety and efficacy, meaning does it work, trials on humans or primates for tetanus. The basis of effectiveness for tetanus is based on history. It's based on the history of disease during wars, which I'm going to talk about next, on guinea pig tests, and on many assumptions. So here's what happened between World War I and World War II. In World War I, there were a report of 70 cases. I believe this was within... It's within a specific place. I believe this is United States data, okay? So we have 70 cases of tetanus World War I, 12 cases World War II. There were 500,000 wounds versus 3 million wounds. And so the rates were much higher during World War I than World War II. And we vaccinated our soldiers during World War II a lot. I mean, we vaccinated them when they enlisted. We vaccinated them every year, and we vaccinated them anytime they had a wound. So the assumption was that it must have been the vaccine that made everything better. So let's take a look at some of the data that we can find in prestigious medical journals, peer-reviewed medical journals. This one here, in 1946, reported on European and African war campaigns of World War II. And they found that there was 22 cases in the vaccinated, 62 cases in the not vaccinated. But look at the death rate difference. There was an 87% death rate in those that were vaccinated and a 48% death rate in those that were not vaccinated. So again, what are we concerned about? The death rate or disease rate? I think we need to be concerned about both and be asking questions about both. But let's look at this. U.S. Army World War II. There are 12 cases. And this paper shows you each case and how many times and when they were vaccinated. And of those 12 people, 7 of them were vaccinated. So why now? Let's go back to our world wars. World War I was fought using horses. The soldiers, the cavalry, were a lot on horses. It was fought in areas of the world that it was lots of farmland, trenches. And so oftentimes the soldiers were covered in mud and water up to their hips. Medical care was not readily available to them. And antibiotics had not yet been invented. So there was a big difference in the stage, as we call it, between these two wars that would have put these soldiers at much higher risk to contract the bacteria and at susceptibility for developing disease from it. They're also, imagine the stress of being a soldier under those conditions. So World War II, they say, was a little more gentlemanly fought war in that there was less hand-to-hand combat. There were almost, I don't know how many horses, but there were nowhere near as many as there were in World War I. You know, we had by then motor cars and tanks and, you know, boats is how some of the transportation occurred. And soldiers were not put into the same situation that they were in World War I. And we, at this point, had more medics on the field and better understanding of wound management. So I think we can't make the assumption that it was just the vaccine that made this big difference. Okay, I want to show you something I find interesting, and I'll tell you why. First off is that there are two branches of our immune system. Okay, so we don't have vaccines for every disease. We don't die from every disease. So we must have another ability to fight disease than just memory immunity, which is what vaccines are supposed to give you, is memory immunity in your blood. So you have a line of defense in your blood, cellular immunity, called innate immunity. And these are cells and some preformed antibodies, but they're non-specific. But they're cells that are ready to go on the attack. And then there's a branch of immunity called humoral immunity. And that has to do with antibody, which having preformed antibody. And what we find when we look at the response of these two arms of immunity after being vaccinated is that 15 to 18% of children do not respond via their cellular immune system. And 12 to 14 don't respond via their antibody system. And that when we look at all of the non-responders, we find around 39% had a deficiency in one or the other kind of response. I find this really interesting,
especially when we think about herd immunity, right? Because we're told that the 3 or 5% of the population that's not choosing to not vaccinate is putting the rest of the population at risk.
But you can see here that for a disease that does have the potential to spread from person to person, that this group of people that was vaccinated is actually much higher, this group of people is much higher than the non-vaccinated children are. And because of the diseases like mumps or rubella, for instance, it's very common for children not to respond to the rubella vaccine. And if we have time, I'll show you the paper that talks about that. So it's not just tetanus vaccines that children are not responding 100% or even close to 100%. We have another paper down here that talked about the fact that, you know, 95% of the population is vaccinated, but we're finding evidence of what they call protection only in the mid-80s, 80%. So these people are the kind of unknown non-immune, but that these people, we don't know that they're not immune, but they actually are not immune. We just assume they're immune. And that if they have a disease that looks like tetanus, they don't think it could be because they say they were vaccinated. So those are the people that don't respond. Now let's look at what can happen in children who do respond. Okay, so this study is important because what this scientist did is they, okay, I have to give you a little history, which is that there was a period of time recently where children in Africa were vaccinated for diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, and the death rate among the vaccinated was much higher for other diseases. And so these doctors said, well, let's look at what happens on a genetic level after we vaccinate a series of children. So today we have the ability to look at these sensitive and sophisticated genetic responses after vaccination. And, you know, we're told that vaccines are kind of one size fits all, that we give the same vaccine to everybody, and that everybody will have a similar response, at least to for hopefully being protected against the target. But what we don't hear is what else happens in the rest of the body after a vaccine. And what we can see here is that each one of these is a different girl. There were 8 girls that were vaccinated, and they look to see genetically what proteins started to be made, because genes make proteins, okay? So after any kind of an intervention or an ingestion, something like this, we can see certain genes becoming activated. And it was, to me, quite alarming to see the different activations that happened. And this is an actual chart from the article, but I broke down, made it a little simpler so we can read it better. But what we found is that there were what I refer to as epigenetic alterations, because it's not a gene mutation, okay? What it is, it's a gene activation. So while we used to think that our genes are our destiny, we now know that they're not our destiny, that only a small percent of our genes dictates what happens to us. Our destiny is about what those genes are told to do. And what those genes are told to do has so much to do with what we're exposed to. So we know that, say, smoking, even eating rice can change your epigenetic profile. So any injection is sure to change the epigenetic profile. So what we find here is that and it happens by signaling, so think of the cell as a ball, and think of the genes on the inside of the ball. On the outside of the ball, there are around 2,000 receptors that respond to what's happening in the broth that cell is bathed in.
So depending on what's hitting the outside of the cell, be it aluminium or formaldehyde or tetanus toxoid, we will see different signals go into the cell and different instructions will be given to the genes, which will make protein. Okay, that's how it works. So we see epigenetic alterations resulting in upregulation of genes that are associated with genetic disorders, cardiovascular disease, gastrointestinal disease, immunological disease, connective tissue disorders, developmental disorders. The list was very long. And these girls all responded differently to each other. And also, there are things called cytokines, which are chemicals in the blood that tell your cells how to respond during an infection. And they found that those cytokines were different in different girls as well. So there's a huge difference. If I was to vaccinate each one of you, the list of what genes would be upregulated would be different in each of you. So it's another thing to consider when taking a vaccine, even if the vaccine works, is that so many other things are being changed. Now, most of us seem to get away with this when we're vaccinated, but we don't have any studies looking at the difference between completely vaccinated versus completely not vaccinated and following out for 20, 30, 40 years. We need that. We could do that, actually, because there's a large portion of unvaccinated children in the United States, but our government does not prioritize or have any desire to do such a study. So at this point, we can't say for sure that the vaccines are causing these things, but we have now evidence that they could be, and we can't say that they're not causing them. And we know from toxicology that many of the chemicals that are in there are stirring up the immune system in ways that are not normal. And I'll get into that more in a bit. So this is another study that I will show you from 2008. This was a Swedish study. And they looked at infants after their diphtheria, tetanus, acellular pertussis vaccines. And polio, Hib. So these were babies, and they got their regular vaccines at 3 and 5 months. And then they took some of their blood out, and they exposed it to the whooping cough toxin, which is basically what's in the vaccine, okay? And then they looked to see what happened 12 hours later in a genetic level. And what this doctor reported was 33 allergy-related genes were activated, 66 asthma genes were activated, 67 cancer genes were upregulated, and 25 immunological genes were upregulated. Okay, so we're definitely seeing on a genetic level some waking up. Now, whether or not if it goes through completely and causes these diseases, no, it doesn't in everybody right then and there. But do we know that unless something comes along and shuts these down, what is the result? We don't know. The first study I showed you on the African girls, the conclusion is that the immunological explanation for the non-specific effects, which is what I'm talking about, of vaccines is not known at present.
Yes,
time out?
I stopped you.
You stopped me. I'm too fast?
You're too full of information.
Oh.
And now it's break.
Okay, good.
And
okay, break. So I just want to show you a couple studies that show that this DTP vaccine, or DTAP, either way, that this vaccine, they show studies that if the vaccine is withheld, that there's less asthma and less atopy, as it's called. And there's several of these studies, and I quickly show you, here's one from Hurwitz from 2000, and he looked at thousands of people and did a statistical analysis, and he said that if we held this vaccine for 1 year, we would find 50% fewer asthma, 45% fewer sinus, 54% fewer allergies, just by looking at who had the vaccine and who developed these cases. Here we have another one from McDonald showing similar. They looked at 11,000 children, looked at them at the age of 7, and saw who developed asthma. And they noticed that if the first dose of this vaccine was held, the rate of asthma was less than 50%. The second dose, less dramatic, but still a decrease. And same with the third dose. So the question is, what if none of them were given at all? And what I observe is the unvaccinated children have far fewer allergies and asthma, far fewer requirements for antibiotics, and overall their immune systems are working properly, and they tend to not develop these kinds of problems. There are known immunologic reasons why this happens, but I don't have time today to get into it. And then a lot of people say, well, Suzanne, you're talking about DTP, but today we use DTAP. But I can show you that actually this study here showed that there was 10% more atopy with DTAP than with DTP. So there's definitely something to think about when it comes to these allergies and reactivity to normal things in the environment, possibly based upon abnormal programming of the immune system in very young children due to vaccination. skip that one. I'm going to skip through all this. There's a way that you can have too many vaccines. We know this. If you have high antibody levels and then get a vaccine, your likelihood of having reaction is much higher. And we know that as time has gone on, that this has become more and more of a problem. You can see here people born before 1968, 17.3%. Sorry, after 1968, 17.3% are hyperimmunization in Italy. Before 1968, only 10% had hyperimmunization. And today, tetanus vaccines are offered for every wound. They're offered in USA for every pregnant woman. Even if she is pregnant every year or every 2 years, they still recommend to give her DTAP for the pertussis. So they're causing her to have hyperimmunization. Okay, vaccine reactions. As of August 2012 in USA, this is our reporting system, where somewhere between 1 and 10% of reactions is ever actually reported. Any vaccine that had T in it, they looked at. 67 deaths and 22,000 adverse events. So the reaction to these vaccines is something to be considered and looked at. I talked about natural immunity. It does happen from eating the spores, which happen in the environment, but you really only get protected by the strain that you've eaten. So I want to talk about autoimmunity, not only because it's important in terms of tetanus vaccines, but it touches into autism, because when you look at what happens with autistic children, there's inflammation in the brain. And so we have to consider the possibility of how vaccines could contribute. And I'll get into that in a minute, but right now I just want to tell you how this happens and what evidence we have. Okay, we are made of protein. Our flesh is made of proteins and water, of course. So bacteria and viruses are also made of protein pieces. So think about, how come you're able to have bacteria on your skin, and how come you're able to have probiotics in your intestines, and they're actually good for you, and you don't get sick from them? What makes the difference between somebody who reacts to everything and somebody who can be perfectly colonized with bacteria and do fine with it? Well, the reason is because nature has devised us to really, in a sense, be one with the world in the microbial world. In your intestines are billions of bacteria, and your bacteria outnumber you by 10 to 1. In your intestine. And the amount of viruses in your intestines outnumbers the amount of bacteria in your intestines. So how come you're not getting sick? It's because nature has devised a way for you to harmoniously live with these microbes, because they're so similar to you. So if you don't react to yourself, you won't react to the microbes. If you don't react to the microbes, you don't react to yourself. So bacteria, there's an article that I advise you to read, it's free. And there's a doctor in Italy named Dr. Daria Kanduk. And she's written much of this kind of research that's showing us today that when they look at the proteins in viruses, in bacteria, and even the proteins in a tetanus toxin or toxoid, that those proteins have so many similarities to our proteins that it's very difficult to make a vaccine that you will respond to. And for that reason, they add aluminium to it to make your immune system respond. Because normally, if I were to inject you with DTaP without aluminium, or if I were to inject you with tetanus toxoid, you would not respond to it because your body already has been introduced to many of these proteins and you are programmed to not respond. Okay, so this is important when it comes to autoimmunity. So something happens to break this tolerance that we have to normal proteins, and then we start to attack ourselves. Our immune system starts to attack ourselves. So the reason for this tolerance, is why we can be loaded with all of these microbes and not react to them and not react to ourselves. Does that make sense? Okay. So the problem, like I said, is that many of the vaccines, in fact, if you read this paper here, it would have to be all of the vaccines, because this paper talks about that every bacteria has proteins that mimic the proteins in our body. Every single one. She says none of them is exempt, not even one. That's the title of the paper. Very important paper. So because of that, this ties into vaccination. I just talked about that the proteins in the vaccines are the same as proteins in us. And so I mentioned that you wouldn't respond to them normally, and that's why the decision to put aluminium into vaccines was made back in the 1940s. And back then, there were just a few vaccines that had aluminium. But today, more than half of the pediatric vaccines contain aluminium, and we're giving them earlier and earlier, before babies even have their kidney function up to normal. We're giving them big doses of aluminium, which can get into the brain, which can alter the immune system, which does epigenetically alter gene function, which changes how enzymes work. So we're giving these huge doses of aluminium to babies today with these vaccines to get the body to respond. And we're told, oh, don't worry, because the kidneys get rid of it. But if I had enough time today, I would show you how that's not true when it comes to babies. And there's research to prove that. They also tell us that we shouldn't worry about aluminium because it's in the environment, it's all in the Earth's crust, because it's in breast milk, because it's found in our bodies, so it must be okay. Well, it's not okay, but the thing I want to point out to you is that there's a huge difference between eating aluminium and being injected into a muscle with aluminium. Even if you're injected intravenously with aluminium, is better than being injected into a muscle with aluminium, because the needle going into the muscle causes a reaction in that muscle that stimulates the immune system. It shows damage, release of particles from inside cells, which stimulates the immune system, and then you add that aluminium and you create a spark that creates a fire, and that fire may not be put out. And now we've creating it possibly against ourselves because of the similarity between the proteins in the vaccine and our own proteins. So this is something that's not just about tetanus vaccine. It's diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccines. It's Haemophilus influenza B vaccines, meningitis vaccines, pneumococcal vaccines, hepatitis A and B. All contain high doses of aluminium. And I believe that this is an indefensible argument, that there's no way to argue that the doses of aluminium that are given to babies today is not a major problem, and that it needs to stop, and we need to stop injecting babies with aluminium.
How about Gardasil?
I don't know what that is.
Gardasil.
Oh, well, I'm talking babies now. Gardasil is for older girls. There's a large dose of aluminium, and the way it's connected onto the protein is unique, and even in my opinion, and according to some of the toxicology literature, even more problematic. Okay, so these aluminium can go into other body parts. It can go into lymph nodes, brain. We know this. It's scientifically proven in peer-reviewed medical literature by scientists that study aluminium. It can react with our own proteins, our own enzymes. It alters gene function, and it has many known harmful effects, and I'd love to tell you all about it. But you can go and get this paper, which is about 17 pages long. It has over 200 medical references describing exactly why and how aluminium is a death element to cell function. Okay? Now, while it might not kill you, it's highly likely in certain populations to make children and adults sick. Okay, so it forces the immune system to overreact so that you can be vaccinated and hopefully immunized. And that's the philosophy. And we've already talked about attacking its own body parts. And here we have, I'm just going to talk about these two because we know, these papers will tell you that the tetanus toxin toxoid has similarities with these molecules in your body. This one here is what makes the outside of all of your cells. Every cell in your body is made of phosphatidylcholine. This one here is in your DNA, in the nucleus of your cell. This is the one when you have lupus, you make antibodies to this, systemic lupus erythematosus. So we have to consider that some of the autoimmunity that we're seeing in society today can be related to the practice of vaccination. Okay, so and this is what you really want to know now is, so what do we do? You know, whether you're vaccinating or not, you need to do this, because vaccinating alone, as I've shown you, is no guarantee to preventing tetanus. Wound care is number one of importance. Nutrition is always important. We outline in our book how, when nutrition changed, the susceptibility to diseases and the mortality went down. And vitamin C is not only preventive, but can actually slow the toxin in its steps. There are many papers that talk about how proper wound care is the most important thing when it comes to preventing tetanus, that it will prevent it in the vast majority of tetanus-prone injuries, which are deep injuries, injuries that involve necrosis or death of tissue, and that are dirty wounds. Those are the ones that are most likely to develop tetanus. This doctor here said he studied the epidemiology of tetanus in 1900 to 1969, and he says that the improvement in wound care had more of an effect than immunization, or may have had more of an effect than immunization in lowering the death rate over the past 70 years. So the first thing people want to do when there's a wound is to stop the bleeding. But unless you have severed an artery, you don't stop the bleeding. I cut my thumb a few weeks ago, and I stood over the sink and just let it bleed for about a minute, because you want to flush from inside to outside. You want your immune cells to be going through, and it's a way to cleanse the wound. And so you want to bleed first. Then you want any kind of foreign body, dirt, splinters, thoroughly removed. If you have a deep splinter, you have to cut into the skin to remove it, because people often leave the tip of the splinter in. You've got to get the whole thing out, open it up, and let it heal from inside out. And then you want to gently flush the wound with water or salt water, never using pressure. What I recommend is taking either salt water or sodium ascorbate and mixing 3 parts water to 1 part either salt or sodium ascorbate, and continuing to clean that wound. And when it comes to treating skin, I have found that the higher concentrations of colloidal silver are more effective. And so I recommend the 200 to 500 part per million for skin disease. Maybe not the same when it comes to taking it internally, but on skin I find this to be true. And so you can get this from iHerb.com, this concentration. In your country, you can get lower concentrations. You can get a 10 part per million here in Sweden.
Let me get it.
parts per million.
Yeah, but what does that mean?
It means how many particles of silver are in. And then you keep watching, because if you see something isn't going, yes.
What about hydrogen peroxide?
Well, okay. Hydrogen peroxide is very good at sterilizing wounds. The problem with hydrogen peroxide, you have to be careful, is if it is a tetanus-prone injury, it can kill cells. And tetanus likes to live in dead tissue. So if it's just a graze on the skin, fine. But if you have a deep wound, I'd rather not see hydrogen peroxide, because you can continue killing cells and it can be a problem. Okay, so always monitor the wound. If you see it getting worse, get to the doctor. If you can't get all the dirt or the particles out, get to the doctor. If you have any doubt, get to a doctor. I prefer not to use stitches. I was taught to use stitches just like that. But anymore, I'll usually, on a wound like this, I'll either do this with just these Steri-Strips, or I'll maybe just put two or three stitches in and then Steri-Strips, because stitches seal it up. And if you have anything caught in there, you could have a problem. And you don't get as good a cosmetic result with these stitches. You get like Frankenstein scar, unless you have a plastic surgeon that does it for you. You get beautiful result with this. I've treated many chin wounds and injuries, all kinds of skin injuries, just by cleaning, removing dead tissue, and gently taping. And then you can continue with antibacterial applications, colloidal silver or sodium ascorbate. I want to tell you two, I'm almost done. I want to tell you two studies of using vitamin C in tetanus. This one was done in rats. And what they did is they had five groups of rats, and they gave them all twice the minimum lethal dose of tetanus toxin. And then they did different things here and looked at the outcome. Okay, so here they gave no vitamin C and all the rats died. Here they gave vitamin C, they developed mild tetanus, and they all survived. Here they gave the toxin after giving vitamin C, and they gave vitamin C ongoing. They developed no symptoms and they all survived. Now this is the group I recommend we all stay in as humans, because after you have a wound, you are potentially this group where you can take vitamin C right away before any toxin is produced. Okay, so you can be this group that has no symptoms and all survive. This one here, they gave higher dose intraperitoneally after symptoms developed. It stopped the symptoms from spreading and they all survived. This one had higher doses after symptoms developed. They all survived. So we can see here that vitamin C has an effect upon the disease, and can, because it's a toxin neutralizer, as well as many other things vitamin C does, that it's a very something that the immune system needs to function properly, and it neutralizes toxins directly. Well, you might say, well, that was just in rats. Who cares about rats? But we have a study in humans from Bangladesh, where usually the death rate is very high from tetanus. And they gave 117 humans that developed tetanus in Bangladesh. And they gave all of them conventional treatment. But half of them they treated with vitamin C. They gave, no matter if you were a baby or you were 70 kilograms, you got 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. And this is the result. Here we have age 1 through 12, the vitamin C group. 31 of these patients, they all recovered, nobody died. Here we have no vitamin C, 31 patients, 74% of them died. Okay, let's look at the 13 to 30-year-old group. 27, 17 recovered, 37% died. No vitamin C, 67.8% died. Why? Because they didn't dose on milligram per kilogram. Had they dosed according to weight, I believe that this rate would have been zero or close to zero. That's how it should be. I would have given these adults maybe 100 grams instead of 1 gram. But you can see even 1 gram, mortality rate was zero in these people. So now you're informed. Now you can be making your decisions from an informed place. You know a little bit more about wound management. You know a lot more about aluminium. And I can talk a little bit about autism if you'd like me to.
Can I just have one about the vitamin C? What kind of vitamin C do you recommend?
Okay. I use this brand because it is inexpensive and highly effective. And people say to me, well, why not natural? Why not natural? And I say, well, because the concentration of ascorbate in this is 100 times more than natural. And when you have a toxin-producing disease, you need high doses. And then we have this lipospheric, which is nice because you can mix it into drinks. You can swab it inside the mouth. You can rub it onto the skin. It's a gel. And I recommend that everybody has both of these in their house always, because whether you have whooping cough or a bad wound or influenza or diarrhea, this is what your immune system needs. If you have a wound, it's what your skin needs. If you have a bone fracture, you can't heal bone without vitamin C. If you have chronic fatigue and adrenal shutdown, you can't make neurotransmitters. Your adrenal glands use a lot of vitamin C, so you need to have this for many different things. Now, I'm not saying don't eat lots of produce that has vitamin C. Always, always eat lots of produce that has vitamin C, but you're not going to get the levels that you can get from even a teaspoonful of this. You get 5,000 milligrams of L-ascorbate. With natural forms, you can get around 250 to 500 milligrams if you're lucky, with camu-camu or rose hips or acerola. And with food, you get, say, in a, what do you call them? You call them paprika. You can get 300 milligrams in one paprika. So we all just got a little bit outside eating slices. And you get the natural form, which is good because it has flavones, which preserves the vitamin C. And so that's good. But you still, you would have to eat a room full of paprika to get what you get in this bottle here. Okay? And if it can prevent you from taking antibiotics or ending up in intensive care unit, I don't care that it's synthetic. It's keeping me out of intensive care unit. And oranges won't do that. Look at children who have become autistic, it's usually more than just vaccination, because you have to look at the whole immune system of the child. And the immune system begins to grow within days of conception. And even the mother's immune system changes at conception. And so immune system function, even the mother's immune system contributes to autism risk in a child. For instance, we now know, without a shadow of a doubt, that what we call maternal immune activation has a contribution to schizophrenia, depression, and autism in children and adults. It doesn't matter if her immune system was stimulated by a war, or by a virus, or a bacteria, or a vaccine. It's maternal immune activation. It completely irrelevant what caused it. So a lot of inflammation in the mother changes how that baby's brain develops. Baby's brains, they basically grow kind of like a bonsai tree, and then the immune system trims it back, and it grows and trims back, and that's how child's brains grow. And it doesn't happen properly in autism. They find bigger brains. They find lots of inflammation in the brain of autistic children. We know their immune systems aren't functioning properly. We know their bowels are abnormal. We know that, I'm giving you a really quick version of my infant immunity talk that's 5 hours long. But we know that even having oxytocin during delivery increases the male autism rate by up to 30%. Okay, so if you basically they're taking oxytocin is a hormone from a cow brain, and they inject that into the mother. So they say it's epigenetically changes something in the baby. Other elements of immune function in babies: breast milk versus formula. Breast milk is a continuation of maternal immunity in the uterus. It's vitally important for exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months, and even the World Health Organization recommends continuing to feed for up to 2 years. So the reason is because this continues to keep the baby in an anti-inflammatory state. Everything from conception to I'd say at least 1 year of age is trying to keep that baby's immune system anti-inflammatory, to keep that baby's body anti-inflammatory. The placenta, the stem cells, the amniotic fluid, all these things are programmed to anti-inflammatory for that baby. Mother's milk is deadly to pneumococcal bacteria, it's deadly to cancer cells, and it does this all without causing inflammation. It's amazing. I mean, there are substances in mother's milk to keep inflammation down and still kill microbes. So everything is designed to stay anti-inflammatory. The kind of microbes that go into the baby's intestines change the inflammatory predisposition of the baby. Having the microbes that they get from breast milk keeps anti-inflammatory. But if you give formula, the microbes in the baby's intestine are totally different. And one bottle of formula will change that baby's intestine for 2 weeks. Okay? So formula is really something that does not contribute to the anti-inflammatory and protective immunologic development of the baby. So those are all just a few of the examples of what I say. It's not just one thing. But let's take a look at vaccination. Let's take a look at what's going on in America, because what we're finding is that as other countries start to change their vaccine programs to mimic ours, their autism rates go up, and I'll show you an example of that. In America today, 1 in 6 of our children has neurodevelopmental disability. 1 in 68 has autism. 1 in 10 has ADD, attention deficit disorder. I mean, you can read the list, and if you'd like, please go to this blog, and in the blog, all the links to the Centers for Disease Control and the official statistics giving you this are all there. Okay, so this isn't some upset mother who made this up. This is official statistics in here. Okay, all right, so we hear all kinds of reasoning as to why we have more autism all the time. We hear that it's environmental. We hear that they change the diagnostic criteria. We hear that the world is more sensitive to noticing. But if you talk to school teachers that are around 70 or 80 years old, they'll tell you that that there were not autistic children in their schools. I remember growing up that there was like maybe one person that was kind of a little off, but there was no huge branch of special education in my school, and we were performing at higher level overall than children are today. So there's definitely something going on. But let's look here, because we changed the diagnostic criteria in 1994. So let's just cut that possibility out completely and look at the rates of increase in the United States. Each year, you can see this is the number, the absolute number that is added to the total number. So you can see that each year from 1994 to 2012, we're seeing an increase, a significant increase. There were 6,000 new cases in 1995, and 2011, there are 37,000 new cases. So what's going on here? Well, let's look at 2011. So this is United States' schedule, and you can see there are many vaccines. We're giving 42 antigens by age 6. So I counted hepatitis B as one antigen, DTaP as 3 antigens, okay? So that's how we count this. Each of the red arrows are vaccines that Finland was not giving in 2011, but they're giving them now. Okay, they just changed it. I had my host when I was there look this up for me, and the new recommendations, the government is now recommending all of these vaccines with the red arrows. Here was their schedule in 2011. This is the official. I just screenshotted the document from the, I think it's Eurozone or something like that. And you can see that they are having 29 antigens in 2011, but they've since then added. But over time, they have also had an increase in their autism rate. But let's look at 2011. 2011 autism rate in Finland was 1 in 86, and ours was 1 in 68. So, you know, the argument is that correlation does not equal causation, but there are lots of reasons to believe that the vaccination rate and the aluminium injection rate can be a contributing factor. Here we have a very important study from 2011 by Tom Linovic and Shaw. These are two independent researchers, and it's really important to read some of the independent research and not just the pharmaceutical-funded research, which is known to be of lower quality and usually has a desired endpoint before the study is even done. So here they just, it's a whole discussion on aluminium from these independent researchers. And what they show is that the more aluminium and the earlier it's given to babies, the higher their autism rates relationship. So here we had Finland, and 12.2 per 10,000 when this paper was written. And you can see their aluminium doses are quite small. And then look at United States and United Kingdom, and you can see we start doing at birth with hepatitis B vaccines. And you can see that much higher doses and earlier administration correlates to the autism rate. Oops. Here we have an article that was written in 2000 by a Finn, and they looked at the autism rates in northern Finland in children between the ages of 3 and 18. And we see in 1991, this is the rate, 4.75. In 1996, we're up to 12.2. And if you look at certain age group between 5 and 7, it's much higher, 20.7. Now, what's happening today? Today, in 2013, this paper was published, and we see it's up even higher, 53.7 per 10,000 overall, and these are the rates in boys and girls. And this doctor says that they are reporting an eightfold increase in the incidence rates of ASD between 1987 and 1992. This is an interesting slide, and I think you need to understand a little bit more than what I told you about the rotten beef heart that goes into tetanus vaccines, because these are just a small sampling of the animal cells that are used to make vaccines. This is a Cocker Spaniel dog, and there is a line of cells called Maiden Darby, and they are tumorigenic Cocker Spaniel kidney cells. And we're told that they are low tumorigenic capacity. And they like the tumorigenic because they divide rapidly and they make ideal substance to make a lot of vaccines. So this is used in some of the flu shots that are given today. We have aborted fetal cells that are used commonly in different vaccines today. We commonly use chick embryo. Caterpillars are in the Cervarix HPV vaccine. Caterpillar cells are used. Monkeys have been used for a long time, their kidneys. Cows, we're using their blood routinely to make vaccines. And we've got pigs. So we now know that just 2 weeks ago, or maybe 3 weeks ago, this important study was released. And this doctor, another independent researcher from the United States, with a very strong curriculum vitae, has come out talking about these human cells that are used to make vaccines. But let me just tell you that they started using these human cells because there were so many problems with the animal cells. Like in the 1950s through the 1990s, there was a cancer virus in these monkey kidney cells that didn't cause any problem to the monkeys, but was correlated to tumors in the brains and lungs of humans. And the doctor who's done much of the research on this virus, an Italian scientist named Dr. Michele Carboni, calls this virus the perfect war machine, because he says he couldn't have designed a better cancer virus if he was able to. So this has been a problem with animal cells. There have been other kinds of viruses that come into animal cells. And so they said, well, let's try these human cells. We can control them better, and it should be safer. Well, here's something. Okay, I have to back up a minute. We normally think of retroviruses as something that's like HIV, right? But in recent breast milk literature, we find that there are retroviruses in humans and that they actually serve a purpose. For instance, if you have a baby that has a genetic disorder and you don't have the genetic disorder, or if you breastfeed another baby who has a genetic disorder and you don't, your breast milk, because of these retroviruses, can actually change that baby's genetic makeup and cure their genetic problems. I'm trying to think. Irmak, I-R-M-A-K, is the author of two of these studies. And he dedicated one of the papers to the baby who was cured of a genetic disorder by a wet nurse, okay? And he goes into details about these retroviruses. Now, we're loaded with retroviruses, like it or not. So these human fetal cells also all have retroviruses. And what we find is with the introduction of the use of these human fetal cells is that we've also seen a rise in autism rates. And you can see there's actually a little curve, a little bend in the curve with each one. This is when we started using the new measles, mumps, rubella made on these cells. This is when we started increasing the compliance to it. This is when chickenpox in USA was introduced, also made on these cells. And here's a hepatitis A came in here. So there was speculation that this could have been related to some of the autism, but now we've got some actual science from this doctor here. Her name is Teresa Dietert, D-E-I-T-E-R-T. Go ahead and read about her. She's actually put out, this is an article you can get for free. And I'm sorry that I can't read this whole thing to you. But if you just Google this human fetal DNA, Teresa Dietert, you will get this. And then in this article, you can find the scientific paper link. It's out there. It's being talked about a lot. And what she's showing is that the combination of the DNA and these retroviruses is a highly likely contributor to abnormal brain function. I told you she's an independent researcher. She has a PhD in molecular and cellular physiology from Stanford University, which is a very well-respected university in the United States. She spent 20 years in commercial biotechnology, so she's worked in industry for a long time. She's an inventor of 23 US patents. She's world-renowned for her work in stem cells. She discovered the stem cells that are in heart. Okay, so this is a lady that's done her homework and knows how to run a lab. And so she has published this paper basically saying that the genetic material from vaccines can incorporate into our genome. Now, to me, it's alarming enough that human DNA can incorporate into our genome, but I find it even more alarming, the possibility that what if we're given two vaccines at once, like kids often are? What if we're given a vaccine that was made on monkey cells or cocker spaniel cells or genetically modified caterpillar cells at the same time? Can that get into our DNA? I think we still have to answer that question, but we know that epigenetically it alters us. I'm just taking a couple quotes from her. This is really interesting because a few years ago, I went searching for the industry protocols on how to manufacture vaccine. And there's a recommendation on what you should try to limit the amount of DNA in a vaccine. And they say that you should limit it when possible. So they always give themselves a loophole, but it's said to be recommended when possible to less than 10 nanograms per dose. And that's what I always remembered. And I thought, I wonder how they came up with that. I still don't know how they came up with that. But Dr. Dietert actually looked at the vaccines to see how much exogenous DNA was in there. And she finds it's between 142 and 2,000 nanograms per dose. So you can see right away how the recommendations to the pharmaceutical companies, the vaccine manufacturers, are one thing, and what happens in reality is completely different. This is a quote from her, that there are a large number of publications about the presence of human endogenous retrovirus and its association with childhood lymphoma. Okay, so imagine if these retroviruses and DNAs are getting into our genes, that of course they'll be able to cause cancer. And she says the measles, mumps, rubella 2, and chickenpox vaccines, and indeed all vaccines that are made using WI38. There are two cell lines of human fetal cells. One is WI38 and one is called MR6. And she says all vaccines that are made on these are contaminated with this retrovirus. Another quote from her is that that these retroviral and human DNA fragments fulfills all of the necessary requirements as a primary trigger for autism disorder. And I don't have time to get into the details of how she describes that, but you can go and read that for yourself. There's a poster presentation by her that's available, and this new paper that just came out. And I've described to you a little bit about how it works through breast milk, these retroviruses, but now we're seeing that it actually works in ways that may not be so healthy and desirable. All right. Well, we were talking about aluminum a little while ago, and this guy here, he's a medical doctor from the United States, and he invented a vaccine, and he has also served on the advisory committee for immunization practices. And this is common in the United States for either vaccine inventors or people who profit from vaccination are serving on the board to tell us what vaccines we should take. That's one thing. But we're constantly told by the pro-vaccine that not only is aluminium something we shouldn't worry about, but that this guy actually said this on his website, which you can go and look for yourself because it's still there. He said, aluminium is considered to be an essential metal with quantities fluctuating naturally during normal cellular activity. And it's found in all tissues, and this is, get this, it's believed to play an important role in the development of a healthy fetus. This is a complete lie. And this is how they're trying to convince you that you shouldn't worry about aluminium in the childhood vaccines. Now, he is not an aluminium scientist. He's never treated a case of autism. Let's get to people who have done their homework. This scientist here that I mentioned before, this is a quote from his paper. He says, yes, aluminium is abundant. It is not essential for life. On the contrary, it's widely recognized neurotoxin that inhibits more than 200 biologically important functions and causes various adverse effects in plants, animals, and humans. And he goes into great detail about how that occurs. Yes, you had a question.
There was a test that aluminium is good. What did they say?
They say that because it's found in breast milk, that it must be good and it must be safe because it's found in breast milk. And they say that because it's in the fetus, it must be, there's no scientific support for how it plays an important role. They says it's believed, okay? So we're talking religion here, okay? We're not talking science when we're talking about believed. He doesn't say it's scientifically shown. Dr. Kawahara scientifically has shown how it's not any of this. Okay, so that's a little bit on autism. I'm almost done aluminium. I just have a couple more things to say about aluminium. I recently discovered, because I was very curious, how did they ever come up with this idea to use aluminium? And it happened in the 1930s where they were giving the vaccines, like for, you know, say like diphtheria or tetanus, and they found that they weren't having much of an immune response by themselves, and they needed something to make it work more vigorously. And they found that when they used dirty vials when they were making the vaccines, that they worked better. So that's where the idea of adding other things. And one of the vials, or you know, apparently was had aluminium in it, and they found that that worked really well. And so back then, there were even scientists who were saying, not only should we not be putting this in our flour and our food, like was being done, put it into the food, but we shouldn't be injecting it. But those scientists were largely ignored even back then. And in 2013 and 2014, we're still seeing most aluminium scientists are saying that we barely know anything about the effect of aluminium in the body. But what we do know is all not good. It's not a nutrient for us. It has no biological effect. I should say, it has no biological purpose except to rev up the immune system. So this doctor says, although traditional aluminum-based adjuvants has been used since the 1930s, there's not enough information about the manner of their actions. But we do know a few things about their actions, which I've already told you. So there's been some question about, are they safe or not, these vaccines with aluminium? And so there was this little study that was done, which looked at one vaccine to see, it was a meta-analysis, and that's basically when you look at a bunch of studies and see if you see any relationship, studies that have already been done. And the conclusion here on this meta-analysis by this Cochrane, Thomas Jefferson, who is actually, you know, pretty unbiased scientist, but what he said in the conclusion was really puzzling. He said, despite a lack of good quality evidence, we do not recommend that any further research on this topic is undertaken. And I thought, well, that's really odd. And then I read the paper again, and the answer was staring me in the face. Because they say that if they were to take aluminium out of the vaccines, that they would have to, the pharmaceutical industry would have to find something to replace it. And they have found squalene, as you know, to try to replace it, but that has been very problematic. They have found used mineral oil, which works beautifully as an adjuvant, but it causes ulcers in the skin. So there have been problems with the other adjuvants that they have found. And they say that if we were to take this aluminium out, that we would have to come up with completely new vaccines, which would have to be trialed first on animals and then on humans, shown to be safe, and investigated before licensing. And that would be very expensive, and the vaccine industry could not afford that, that there's no obvious candidate to replace aluminium, and that they do not think that threatening immunization programs worldwide should be done. So in other words, the individual health of your child is not as important as continuing immunization programs, even though we don't know that they're safe or not, even though we've never proven that these escalating doses of aluminium are not a problem. This isn't the first time we've seen information being published in medical literature or medical bulletins saying, enough, let's just not talk about this anymore. This document, the bottom part, is a clip that is taken out of a Federal Register from America in 1984, the Department of Health and Human Services. It listed rules pertaining to polio vaccination campaigns in the United States. And this came about after decades of controversy about this vaccine, which I wrote about in my book. But there were a lot of people who were skeptical about not just the injected polio vaccines, but also the oral polio vaccines, because there's a history of problems with both of them in the United States. And so this Federal Register was released, which says directly, I just took a screenshot and highlighted it for you, that any possible doubts, whether or not well-founded, and I think that's the key here, so whether or not there's science behind it, whether or not there's thousands or hundreds of thousands of parents saying they know they've watched a problem happen right afterwards, whether or not well-founded about the safety of the vaccine cannot be allowed to exist in view of the need to assure that the vaccine will continue to be used to the maximum extent consistent with the nation's public health objectives. Now, this would be one thing if public health was just a government agency that was interested in public health. The problem we have is the conflicts of interest, which are exposed rather frequently between our government, the vaccine industry, and academia. So the problem exists that even back in the days of polio, that the scientists who got the money were the ones who were agreeable to the end result, which was to make a vaccine a certain way, even though, actually I believe it was Swedish scientists were saying that we were going to cause a problem with this particular vaccine. There was a Swedish scientist, Sven Gard, his name was, and he said that the way we were inactivating our polio vaccine was not complete, and that we were going to see problems infecting children with live polio virus, even though the vaccine was supposed to be a killed virus. Well, it turned out that Sven Gard was correct. And the year that that vaccine was released, there were more paralytic cases from the vaccine than there were from the natural virus. Now, doctors like him who agreed with him didn't get funded to do research. And there are other doctors who back at the time, Myers is his name. Myers, he's one of the statisticians who came up with Myers-Briggs test. But anyway, he's been quoted as saying that the scientists who got the funding were the scientists who were most agreeable with the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. And this is still the way it is. You know, the scientists who are working together in academia with the government and with the vaccine industry are the ones that keep the money circulating within themselves. And scientists like Dr. Teresa Dietert are not getting that kind of money funneled into her lab. She has to get her money a different way. So anyway, just something to be aware of, that these government health agencies are usually intertwined with industry. The head of our Centers for Disease Control took a job for Merck Vaccine. She's now the Merck Vaccine CEO. There was another scientist who was working on the autism studies that are most famous, working between United States and Denmark. And that doctor took a job with the vaccine industry 2 years before he was finished doing the research on autism. So we have to be aware of this. Now, we've covered a lot of ground, and I could just spend the rest of the time doing question and answer if you'd like to do that. Yeah, okay.
What's your opinion on vitamin K that's being administered to people?
My opinion is that the more I read about vitamin K, the more I can't believe that it's injected into newborn infants, and that if you look at my scientific endeavors have really shown me that by and large, nature on overall didn't make mistakes like this. That nature didn't leave out vitamin K from babies, and that until babies are 6 months old, they're not actually having a full coagulation, normal coagulation. So there's a reason, just like babies are programmed to be anti-inflammatory, I believe that babies are programmed to not have numerously higher levels of coagulation than adults. Also, if you look at the coagulation supposed deficits that a baby has, it's not just the vitamin K factors. So I would suggest that you read a lot about it, and consider if you feel better about giving it, then only give the drops. But most people I know who understand the difference don't give any at all. And if you do give it, maybe it would just be if there was an extremely traumatic birth. But you have to understand some of the things that medical interventions do at birth. For instance, when the baby is born, what happens is it's a very tight passageway, as we all know. And so the baby is squeezed very tightly. The cranium is made so that it can compact in on itself. The brain is squeezed. There's trauma all throughout the body. About 30% of babies will have microhemorrhages from a normal delivery. Now, afterwards, in most societies, that cord is clamped right away, which is a problem. because you're not only leaving behind up to 40% of that baby's blood that belongs to that baby, but you're also leaving behind stem cells, which have the potential to go in and clear up any of the problems that happened in the brain or elsewhere. Now, if you thicken the blood, what is it, 2,000 times more or something like that? Then how is that going to affect the ability for those stem cells to go where they need to go? If you're, when you have these vitamin K factors, those areas that bleed tend to clot, and it's a little harder to clear that out than if you just leave it that way. The concern is always the minority, this vastly small percentage of children who can develop an intracranial hemorrhage, and it can be problematic. So we're now treating everybody for this problem. So I think it's important to understand the full spectrum before agreeing to the injection, and it should be your personal decision that you feel comfortable with after knowing what there is to be known about vitamin K, which I believe in the USA has been given since the 1970s, something like that. But before that, we weren't giving it. The other thing is that if the baby's clotting is not full until 6 months of age, how long is your injection going to work for? So it's not completely logical that giving a huge injection on the first day of life is going to protect them over the long term. But I think that it's always a good idea for mothers to consume lots of greens during the entire pregnancy, if possible, because not only do you get vitamin K that can be delivered to the baby in normal amounts if they need it, but you're also getting folic acid and magnesium and lots of other minerals that are required to build a baby.